Before we start this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including the Stitcher Radio app for your mobile device, iTunes, our website air-raid.net, and of course at www.cairoradio.com. Hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 220 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Yes, indeed, folks. Yes, indeed. We've got a great show planned for you this week. Author and psychotherapist Joe Guppy will be joining us here in the backyard shortly. He has a book out called My Fluorescent God, which is mind-blowing. Literally mind-blowing. I don't read a lot of books. I'm gonna step out of the closet. I'm gonna tell you guys the truth. I wanna be truthful with you. I wanna be straightforward. I don't read a lot. Don't have time for it, really. But I did read this book, read the whole thing. And it's fantastic, and it's sad, and it's scary, and it's totally true. So we'll be talking with Joe about all that in a little bit. But before we do that, we've got a couple things to talk about here on this episode 220. 220, folks! Oh my God, we are really just still going. We're really just still going. That's about all I can say, right? we wanted to thank all of you. Maybe you're new to the show, or you've been listening for a while. We've been getting a lot of emails lately, and I've been trying my best to get back to all of you. So if it's taken me a while to respond to questions, or you know, just send you an email saying thanks, then. For listening, I apologize. I apologize right now. We've been getting a barrage, but it's always great, man. It's always really great to get feedback from you folks that are listening to the show. So thank you so much. If you've been writing us, we really appreciate it. And we're doing right now. We're doing this thing. We want you guys to take the pledge, much like Mike Pesca's show, The Gist, that they were doing. They, they had this great idea. Take the pledge. You don't have to pledge money. It's not money. We just want you guys to pledge to sign somebody else up for the Air Raid podcast, or at least mention it in conversation. Tell some people about the Air Raid podcast, right? Let's get it out there. And we've been hearing from a lot of folks saying that they've been doing this, and we've been seeing some of that in our numbers. So thank you guys so much. Thank you so much. This is wonderful. And I hope the new listeners, people just tuning in, I hope you guys enjoy the show as well. Guys and gals, I should say, right? Yeah. We're also working on a new website for you guys. We're stripping some stuff away. We're going to make it more sleek, more updated, and more grown up. Because I don't think that our website right now, air-raid.net, really conveys to, the person who comes to the website what the show actually is. So this show has changed, man. It's changed. You've really changed, man. It's changed, right? It's grown up. It's matured. And I want the website to reflect that. So we're working on that, too. I'll keep you posted on that one. Remember, you can go to our website, though. Everything is still operational. Don't worry. You can go to our website, www.air-raid.net. Click on the Archives tab and check out all 220 episodes with the likes of Chris Walla from Death Cab for Cutie. Just actually saw him, ran into him today on the street. We were going to eat some Swedish pancakes. And Chris and his wife, his lovely wife, were on their way there too, and got to chat with him for a little bit on the sidewalk. Of course, he has left Death Cab for Cutie and is pursuing, you know, other ventures like being a producer and owning a awesome record label. So good luck to you, Mr. Walla. We love you, sir. We had a great conversation with him, too. And you can find that at the archives page, along with many, many others like Macklemore, Bob Saget, Jim Brewer from SNL, and what's that? Half-Baked? The movie Half-Baked? Yeah, that Jim Brewer, guys. Mike Birbiglia, Eddie Pepitone, whole range of people there for you guys to listen to. Great conversations. How about Mudhoney? How about Presidency of the United States of America? How about all that right there at www.air-raid.net. Okay, hey, one more thing before we get started here. Have we started yet? I think we've started yet. One more thing as we get started here. We're doing this thing called Hash of the Titans with along with Goose Island Beer and Dew206.com. I told you guys about this last week. It's starting this week. So follow Goose Island Beer Company on Twitter, follow Dew206, follow me at Air Raid Net, and you can basically enter to win a trip to Lollapalooza 2015 in Brazil. In Brazil, people. Airfare, hotel, everything is paid for, except for your food and drink, of course. But go see Lollapalooza in friggin' Brazil, man. And yeah, I mean, this is fantastic, guys. There's daily prizes as well. Monday, which is, you know, the day that most of you will hear this, $100 Sonic Boom gift certificate for the most popular tweet or something that Goose Island finds funny. And what they're doing is basically what they do on that show Midnight on Comedy Central with Chris Hardwick. So Hash of the Titans. Follow us all and find out how to enter and we'll go from there. Okay, all right. Okay, sounds good, right? Follow us on Twitter at Air Raid Net. You can also find Goose Island at Goose Island and Dew206 at Dew206. So that's it, folks. And it's going to be super easy. So why not try to win a trip to Lollapalooza, Brazil, 2015? Sounds pretty simple to me. Jesus, get on it, will you? All right, so, okay. This book, My Fluorescent God, which is now available everywhere. You can go to Amazon.com and just type it into a search, find it there. You can also find him on Facebook. Joe Guppy. Joe Guppy has an amazing story about when he was a younger lad and going down to Mexico, being a bit depressed about a breakup, and then taking some, like, gastrointestinal pills that were supposed to help him not have, you know, poo problems, right? Taking those pills, and those pills triggered a psychotic break. To the extent that he was seeing things, hallucinating, hearing things, I mean, just crazy, right? Just crazy. And scary, super, super scary. I mean, it started hitting him on the flight back to Seattle, his hometown. This story is amazing. It's absolutely amazing, and it's very frightening. And for somebody like me, it hit very close to home. I have battled in my past with a lot of depression. I have battled with suicidal tendencies, not the band, and still to this day battle with bouts of schizophrenia. This is something that I've never talked about on this show before. I felt it was pertinent to bring it up because I mentioned it in passing while talking to Joe in our conversation. And I don't know how far I want to get into it, but it's a tough thing, man. It's a really tough thing having to deal with something that you know is not there, right? But it manifests itself and... how do I say this? It manifests itself and shows itself to you, right? But you know it's not there. Like these voices, right? I used to battle with this all the time, especially in my teenage years. I've gotten much better at, like, controlling it now without the use of drugs, which I really don't like taking drugs for this. I don't like taking antidepressants. I don't like taking psychotropic drugs to help me. And sometimes, you know, it gets a little hard to deal without those things. But you know, I've managed, right? But in my teenage years, I used to lay in bed. Sometimes I'd be laying in bed and I'd just hear voices, familiar voices too, voices from people that I know, right? Just screaming in my ear, screaming my name, telling me to do things, telling me to get up and walk around the house, telling, you know, nothing bad, but just telling me to do certain things and screaming at me so loud I can't sleep, right? So this book, reading this book, I was basically transferred back into that mind state. And any good book will do that, right? Any good book will put you in the place of the subject. But this one was a little real, right? It was a little real for me. It took me back to that place that I was in my worst state. And I don't, you know, it hasn't gotten that bad since, you know, since I was like maybe mid-20s. But man, just remembering back to all that stuff, remembering, you know, dealing with that stuff and going through withdrawals off of different medications that I would be on. Anti-anxiety drugs are the worst, you guys. They are the worst. And coming down off of that kind of stuff is just horrendous. It's a horrendous experience. I don't even know where I'm going with all this. I don't know how to... I don't know how to compartmentalize all this stuff and give it to you in a digestible story, but you know, this book really brought some feelings back, and I urge you guys to read it if you've ever had experiences like Joe's or like mine. Mine was much more subdued than Joe's, of course. He was actually in a mental institution here in Seattle, but wow. You know, it's a fascinating story, and I hope you guys check it out. My Fluorescent God, available now. So go do that, will you? All right, let's get started with this. This is an excellent conversation. I really, really enjoyed talking with him, and hopefully we'll have him back on the show at some point, and we can talk to him again. Just about, like, you know, not even about the book. Maybe not even about his experience, but just pick his brain. He has become a psychotherapist, and man, that's something that I need to learn more about, as you can probably tell. So let's do this, shall we? Let's go with our first musical break. We're featuring music today from The Duchess and the Duke, and this song is called Reservoir Park. And when we return, we'll be talking with author and psychotherapist Joe Guppy here in the backyard. All right, everybody, stay with us. Taking people everywhere. Well, I wish that I could go there. I wish I could be somewhere. But I know I'm still right here, and I know here is still nowhere. And the clouds keep rolling on in. Well, tell me. To have my fortune told. She said, you ain't got no future. You ain't never growing old. And the clouds keep rolling on in. Well, how many times have I defied the cold clutches of death? And how many times have I stopped short from taking that last step? And every time I've tried to hurt you, I have only hurt myself. And the clouds keep rolling. We'll be right back. You know, I'm usually the type of person that doesn't get real freaked out about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I do take the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was on the bus coming home from my day job yesterday, and I was reading your book, and I started noticing people around me that were coughing and sneezing and you know, wiping their nose on their hand and stuff like that. And I'm like, I had one of those moments where I was like, I've never been freaked out about this before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't watch the news for that reason alone.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm really starting to think about this shit.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Well, it's very natural. Nancy had like a little stomach upset or something the other day.
Yeah.
And I think about it. I mean, it passes through my mind, Ebola. I'm not rationally thinking Nancy somehow has Ebola, but your sort of alert level goes to a higher level.
I know. Yeah. And it's so weird how this stuff just kind of gets pushed into your brain, right? Like it's a, you know, pardon the pun, but it's crazy making, Joe. it's making me a little bit crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like they say that kids are safer today than they were in the 50s or 60s, but we hear more about the abductions.
Oh, exactly.
You know, even though the statistics are minuscule, but what parent wants the idea of their kid to be the one in a million that does get abducted?
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Guppy joining me in the backyard. And I forgot to turn my
Are we
phone
on the
off.
Air already?
We are. Or? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. This is what I do. You know, I get you comfortable and then we start talking about the real shit, Joe.
Oh, okay. All right. So when do we start? all right. It doesn't matter. Doesn't
Author
make any difference.
Of this new book called My Fluorescent God, which I've been reading for the last like week or so, and it's so good. It's a story about how you kind of had a psychologic break.
Yeah,
almost. Right.
Yeah, it's a combination thing. I mean, I was the events in the book take place in 1979. Well, 78 was a very rough year for me. I had broken up with a girlfriend. It was one of those early 20s hyper romances.
The one you think that you're going to be with forever.
Right, and you're floating on cloud nine, and so that broke up and broke my heart, and I felt like I was going nuts, you know, like that summer, the way one does around that breakup. And then I was also having issues with my job, was kind of a dead end, and I was scamming.
What were you doing at the time? What was your job?
I was working at a English language school that was based on the campus of Seattle University. It was actually pretty good job. It just was kind of, I was only working 20 hours a week, and it felt
so
like
straight kind of out of college kind of
yeah
thing.
Exactly yeah. trying to find your feet, and I had been a high achiever in college, and then you're kind of cut loose. Well, you're an adult now, you're 21 years old, make your way in the world. I think it's a common experience. So I was already on that kind of existential angst, early 20s shaky place. So it was kind of a perfect storm. Then I took a trip to Mexico to look into the idea of teaching English in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And I had with me a travel medication that my doctor had given me that was like a stomach medicine, the way he described it to me. And so I felt a little queasy, took a couple of those pills. It turned out that they had a side effect called toxic psychosis, which I had no clue about whatsoever. And so I started to decompensate and hallucinate and just go bonkers.
Yeah.
And I just assumed, well, this is a continuation of the stress. I've already, you know, it's kind of culture shock going to Mexico, and I was like on the edge. So I ended up with kind of rocket boosters into Psychoville. And even though the obvious effects of the hallucinogenic experience and such wore off in about maybe a week or so, it's hard to tell exactly, I was still in this psychotic place. I had made all these delusional adjustments to what was happening to me.
Now, you said that you were having, and this is spelled out in the book too, like you were actually seeing things.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
like alterations, like people's faces would look weird.
Right.
Shadows would come in and get darker in certain areas and stuff.
Yeah, and like the most extreme example would be the whole visual field in front of me would be like granular sand, and it would like be like falling almost like a waterfall.
Whoa.
So I'd catch I kind of see an image of reality, and then it would just sort of melt and fall.
Yeah.
That was the most extreme. But also on the plane ride back, I looked out the window.
So this is hitting you as you're coming back.
As
to
I'm
the
coming
States.
Back to Seattle, I looked out the window, and I thought the city was being bombed.
I remember that description.
Yeah, it was like smoke and flames. Yeah. And
the first part of the book. This is totally meant as a compliment. The first couple chapters of the book really grabbed me,
mm-hmm.
and pulled me in to that world,
right?
Because the descriptions that you're giving are, even though they're not in insanely wordy, for lack of a better term.
It's
very descriptive. It's mm-hmm. it's like it was the same kind of sensation that I had when I was reading The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Oh yeah, that's a great book. Yeah,
you know, and it really you just put the reader right in there with you,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of an unsettling feeling because, mm-hmm. Like with The Road, the book The Road. It makes you feel uneasy,
mm-hmm.
and it kind of puts you in the space of the author, in that situation. So, and I've had, you know, in the past, like I'm a very anxious person.
Mm.
I've had bouts of schizophrenia in my past
and so
being back in that mm-hmm. zone is very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable for me as the reader.
Yeah. One of the other, my other readers told me that, I think he was getting a massage or something, or no, it was acupuncture. And
okay.
the acupuncturist left the room and he started to get these paranoid feelings like, what's going on? What's happening? Is something suspicious happening?
Yeah.
And he was in the midst of reading the book. So yeah, terrific endorsement. If you want to have the feeling that you're going crazy, get my book, My Fluorescent God by Joe Guppy. Thanks for the endorsement.
Yeah, wow. And, yeah, this is going well, isn't it?
The on the back cover, one of the blurbs I have, captures the world of mental illness and made me feel like I was right there in it.
Yes.
You know, I really, that's Bob Nelson, who used to be
He
used to be on Almost Live and nominated for an Oscar for
Nebraska,
which is a great film.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm really looking forward to
it. It's really, really a good piece of work.
Yeah.
But, that's terrific. But anyway, we digress. The point is that, that was one of my primary goals as a writer was to take us inside the experience. And then kind of as a therapist advocating for proper treatment of the mentally ill, I wanted to engender empathy and understanding
Well, let's get into that in a little bit.
Sure.
I still want to kind of focus on the original story. So,
So
you're flying back into the States. This thing is starting to hit you, or like, are you starting to feel that on like at the airport in Mexico? I mean, is anything hitting you over in Mexico that something may not be right?
You know, it didn't really strike until I had left Mexico. But
okay.
I think that's accurate. Honestly, it's a little, sometimes the lines get a little blurry because I really was under a lot of stress. And,
sure.
I was just remembering an incident in Mexico, but... You know, I'm not even sure whether it happened before or after I took the pills.
Uh-huh.
I think that instance was just travel stress.
Yeah. That's amazing and so scary.
Yeah. But it's their demarcation when the overt hallucinations began. That's mm-hmm. like that coming into the airport. That's when I'm okay.
Yeah.
I know this is the effect of the drug.
Had you ever done LSD?
I never did, although I did have some rough experiences on eating marijuana, which marijuana brownies, which is underrated for just how powerful.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny how there's this casual, marijuana is legal now. Here, have a cookie, you know. And they don't realize that eating marijuana is a much different experience.
Yeah, right after you eat five of them, the person goes, oh, shit, no, you should have just eaten half.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm definitely very, I mean, even to this day, I'm very susceptible to medications and drugs. I'm clean and sober, as we say today, so I just don't mess around with any of that stuff. It's just, for me, it works a lot better. But
So what happens when you get off the plane? You get into Seattle. You're already starting to feel this weirdness, right?
Yeah.
You're aware of it,
mm-hmm.
obviously. And what happens next? Where do
you
go from there?
Well, I have just a rough couple of days. That evening, I was really freaking out. I came to my parents' house at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I got this idea that maybe I'm dead, and so I cut on my hand with a razor, and until I bled. It wasn't mm-hmm. wasn't a lot of blood. It was just enough to show that to show myself. That was proof to me that I was alive. So I was in a pretty ragged spot, and then the next morning after having just a very tough time holding it together, I told my parents that I felt like I was going crazy. And at this point, I could read a couple of paragraphs.
Please, I would love it.
Of the first, when they took me to group health on Capitol Hill. It just picks up right here. So my parents take me in the car, and soon we are pulling up in front of an outpatient mental health clinic on South Capitol Hill. From somewhere inside my confusion, I'm glad something is being done. As we walk up the pebbly concrete sidewalk, I look up and see that the building is constructed with a terrifying, surrealistic geometry. Walls and sections impossibly overlap in shifting angles. It's painful to look at. Grinding mechanical metal parts are chained and hanging randomly on the exterior. We make our way through a narrow maze of humming yellow corridors as my head grinds with a humming yellow headache. I'm left alone in an office with a social worker. He shakes my hand and says his name is Mr. Wiener, like what my dad boiled up for breakfast. This seems to me like an impossible coincidence, a sign that I've passed into another dimension. Mr. Wiener has an enormous hooked beak, sunken cheeks, and he makes a loud gulping sound when he speaks that shakes the room. His Adam's apple careens up and down his loose turkey neck. I tell Mr. Wiener I still think a lot about my old girlfriend, Lori. I sob into the tissue he gives me. He looks at me kindly, like things should be better now, but the way his eyes bug out and his skin wobbles makes me pray his face doesn't slip down the front of his skull.
Oh my God. Okay, so you wrote this. You read this back.
Mm-hmm.
What does that conjure in you, the writer?
Well, it's multiple tracks. You know, I like the writing. I like the way it came out as a writer.
Yeah.
But I still have the actual memory. You know, the memory lives in me of being in that office, and I remember that I was having kind of unfiltered perceptions. And so he really later on in the book I go and in reality I went back and with a tape recorder after I had regained my sanity, but I was only like a month into sanity.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I went back and interviewed him, and you can hear on the tape that he does make this little gulping sound. He has like this vocal tic, like a like that.
Really.
So I was perceiving some kind of reality, but in this scene,
it
was enormously loud, and it literally seemed that he would go, and it would, like, the walls would shake when he did that.
Wow.
So,
and this is kind of the start in the book too, where you're making a lot of comparisons, right? You're comparing a lot of different things where, you know, like you said earlier, you're trying to make yourself believe,
mm-hmm, yeah.
right? Or you know, you're making the comparison of, now it's slipping my, mind now, but you made the, there was something that your father had done earlier or cooked wieners.
Oh,
and his
right.
last name was Wiener.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah. The associations.
And,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
yeah,
yeah you're yeah, associating yeah. these two
right.
different things
right.
and you're using that as proof that like, mm-hmm. oh, somebody's fucking with me.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
like the devil is almost messing with
yeah,
me.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm in a different dimension. I think what it is it's a, when reality is kind of crumbling and things don't make sense, then in a paranoid state, we try to make connections and somehow see a pattern that makes sense. But of course it's a terrifying pattern.
Sure.
You know, like,
sure.
But of course it literally is true that my dad was boiling up this horrible Polish sausage, which is typical of his breakfast. I mean, he really would do that. But the way I perceived
I love your dad right now.
Yeah, he. Well, he's from British stock, and you know they eat those weird meats and meat. He loved those liver pies or whatever it is.
That, oh, yum!
Yeah. But yeah, making that association when I heard this guy's name was Mr. Wiener, it was like like this can't possibly be real.
This is a cruel joke.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is a cruel joke.
Yeah, somebody is playing a cruel joke on me there. And it, I don't know if you ever saw the this Twilight Zone episode. There's more than one, I'm sure, but where a guy is, he thinks he's in heaven and he's really in hell. I don't know if you ever saw that episode.
I don't think so. I don't think so. It's ringing a bell though.
Yeah, he goes through. He wakes up and there's a pool table there and there's beautiful women and stuff. And then by the end of it, though, he's like ripping the curtains and there's just a brick wall.
Right,
and he's trapped.
Right. He can't leave the room.
And the guy that he thought was his buddy is like cackling Satan like and stuff like that. So, so that was kind of the, where I kind of thought I was, like in this other reality that was going to be revealed at any moment. You know, this is hell.
Where you were raised fairly religious.
Yeah,
as well,
I was a
Catholic,
St. Joseph's Church, St. Joseph's School, which fortunately is a lot different place now. That old time religion of threatening kids with eternal damnation. They're certainly not as harsh about it as they once were. And with the new Pope, our new Jesuit Pope, there's more acceptance. Coming down the line all the time, it seems, which is a wonderful thing. But but in my time, it was a kind of Vatican II was the reform, and pre-Vatican II was the old time fire and brimstone. You're going to hell. Watch your step. God is just poised to ready to punish you any time and throw you to the fires of hell.
Well, it surprises me with how many people were raised in that version of Catholicism.
Yeah.
There aren't more people who are, you know, going crazy with fear.
Yeah. No.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I was never raised in that type of household.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the exact opposite, which I've talked to at length, talked about at length on this show.
Mm-hmm.
But it's always very interesting to me. We had, a guy by the name of Corey Duncan, who's in this excellent band called Au Pairs, on the show recently. And he was talking about, he had mentioned something about, his parents were kind of mentally preparing him for, Seventh Night or something akin to that, where it was like,
this is in the Catholic tradition.
I don't know if it was Catholic or not, but it was where Satan was going to take over Earth for 7 days or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And you had to lock yourself inside, and you couldn't answer the door, even if like it was your neighbor, it was actually Satan,
right,
or something. Like
yeah,
that,
I don't think that's Catholic, although there's certain elements that would be similar. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Interesting.
But it just sounds. I mean, it's so scary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's so scary.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder what were they thinking. I mean, you tell a. a 10-year-old that your immortal soul is in danger of eternal torture. I mean, as it says in the book, you know, my fifth grade religion book literally had the words, those who disregard God's laws are tortured with eternal torture in hell.
So this is obviously something that you're struggling with already.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. And yeah, in fact, I met just before I came over here, I met with a psychoanalyst.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Who was interested in using the book in her classes, and we were just talking about that, and now I've lost my train. What were we talking about just now?
Religion and how it kind of
played
into
so,
your fear.
So what we were talking about was how the meaning of delusions. Like one of the things that I'm on the soapbox about is not to dismiss crazy people. The phrase like "out of your mind,"
sure,
he's out of his head. Implies that there's nobody there, and that we talk about the lunatic ramblings. Well, what I say is listen to the words for the meanings, because I think my first psychiatrist pretty much dismissed these lunatic ramblings. He didn't listen to what I was saying, but as we've just been discussing, all my fears about hell and such were based out of my childhood experience. So as I was talking to the psychoanalyst, what we were saying is that I had this psychic crack that had been like opened up when I was 10 years old, this fear of God, fear of damnation, unresolved. That was a wound then this rocket ship into Psychoville opened that wound up.
Yeah.
And there was material there to deal with that my other psychiatrist, my second psychiatrist and the nurse Patricia would take seriously and listen to me. And also that Jesuit priest, probably most of all, was willing to engage with me on those issues.
Father
Pat Carroll.
Yeah, Carroll. Yeah,
yeah. In fact, he was at my reading at Elliott Bay just a few weeks ago. Yeah.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's just great to have linked up with him again. Yeah. And also the psychiatric nurse, Patricia, was also at the reading at Elliott Bay.
Wow. Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, it became obvious in the first, I don't know, 5-6 chapters of the book of where, like, you know, it was like, okay, so this is trauma, that may have, not in like the physical sense of the word, but mental trauma that had happened to you as a child that is physically manifesting itself in your reality.
Right.
You know, because of this little pill that was supposed to give you solid poops.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's right. It was a anti-malarial medication.
Oh, actually, okay.
But I was not aware of that. I didn't know what it actually was. And it turns out that other people have a similar story around similar medications.
Yeah.
But it is. Yeah, that is really the purpose of the medication is not to open up psychic wounds from your childhood. Right. But that's what happened.
It's to stave off malaria.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I have heard a lot of malaria drugs too give you some pretty crazy dreams.
Right.
Right.
That's the same phenomenon.
It's the same thing.
It's just the same.
Is this the same drug that is available today?
Yep.
Really?
Sure.
Oh wow.
I don't know if it's the exact same one that I took, but I know that there's you go to a large enough party or something, and you say, "Hey, has anybody ever taken an anti-malarial drug?" And kind of felt pretty weird to some degree or another, and you'll get the show of hands.
Yeah,
you know?
Totally.
I mean, that's what I found out after having written the book.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So okay, so back to your story. You go and you meet with Dr. Hardaway.
Yeah,
was that right?
No, the first psychiatrist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now how does I can't remember fully. How does it turn out that you actually get you become a patient, basically at this mental facility?
Well, I was in an intake, got a hospital intake interview with Dr. Hardaway.
Yeah,
and he's all he has to hear is that I'm suicidal, that I wanted to jump off the Aurora Bridge, and I'm in. You know, in retrospect, I now know it's even harder to get treatment today than it was then, and it was not easy.
Really?
Not easy then. That is another where the kind of my social political soapbox comes into play here. In retrospect, I didn't realize how hard it is to get treatment and that I was just saying the magic words, "I want to kill myself," and then, okay, you're in. You can get treatment if you tell your say something like that.
Yeah. Now, what kept you from doing it? Was it more fear of eternal damnation?
Sometimes it seemed like the fear of eternal damnation was what prevented it. Not all the time.
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, I was fixated on this method of jumping from a high place, and I've never psychoanalyzed myself enough to know quite why that was my method. But that's a good thing because I had to get to a high place in order to pull off my plan. And so confined in the mental hospital, other than jumping out the second floor window. See, they were smart. They put the mental ward on the second floor. So even though I succeeded in jumping out the window,
you're just going to hurt yourself.
Yeah, I knew that I
which
wasn't.
Which is what happened.
Right. I knew I wasn't going to kill myself, but what I wanted to do was get out of there and go. I had a plan for a place that I could go to a high spot, but this security guard recaptured me.
This is a perfect spot to go with another reading from your book, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
This is after. We didn't really explain that too well, but you did actually jump out of the
The first night I was there, yeah. I just couldn't take it anymore. It was the smoking on the ward that really drove me nuts. They had given me a drug called Haldol, which is a very powerful antipsychotic, and mm-hmm. one of the side effects of that drug is this thing called akathisia, which is a sense of inner restlessness. So it actually increased that anxiety feeling that I had.
Like your limbs have to move.
Yeah. You kind of, it's actually been used, and not to over-dramatize, but seriously, it's been used as a torture drug by the Soviets.
Wow. Really?
In the gulag. Obviously, you know, with an intent and to a greater degree than what I experienced,
sure.
but it really has been used that way.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So this wonderful healing drug I had this effect of increasing my agitation, so I just had to get out. And I'm proud to say I'm a resourceful fellow. I discovered this window that I could open, and I got out.
Amazes me that there were any windows that were
I know.
Able to open.
Well, this was, in all fairness, this was the lower security ward.
Right,
so
right. That's true.
I earned a ticket to the higher security ward by jumping out this window. And anyway, I could pick up the story here. So I land hard and start limping up the sidewalk. For a few seconds, it feels great to be free. I'm locked on my goal, suicide, and my steely determination makes everything clean and simple, like the plain moonlight that shines on the sidewalk at my feet. But someone is talking to me. Hey. Hey there. I look around. A short security guard is coming up behind me. He's a clean-cut, perky fellow with sandy hair. Say, do you need some help? He asks. No, I can kill myself all on my own, I say. My name's Mike, he says, coming alongside. Where are you going? Are you a cop? I ask. Do you have a gun? He tells me no. Too bad, I say, because you could shoot me. Mercy killing. Another security guard shows up. Now that he's got backup, Mike is brave enough to grab my arm. His grip is firm but gentle. Let's go back to the hospital, he says. Fuck, 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 I say. It looks like you hurt your ankle. I let him wheel me around. Fuck, 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 I say. He takes a peek at my hospital bracelet and starts calling me Joseph. They should take a look at that ankle, Joseph, he says. Fuck you, Mike, I say, but not in a harsh way. We take a few more steps. I just want to kill myself, I say. Those meds they gave me have really messed me up. We walk into the hospital entrance. As Mike pushes the elevator button, he waves off the second guard. We go up in the elevator. My cursing and Mike's soothing tones echo inside our little metal box. I start talking about hell and religion and God. Keep the faith, Mike says. No matter what, God will always be there. He'll be there to look over your shoulder. Fuck, 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 I say.
And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears. Stay with us.
Yeah.
I'm talking about being feeling immodest about some awesome, awesome author.
You want me to take it out? I can edit this down, Joe. Yeah.
I was just trying to help out a buddy here.
Well, it's hard to follow that, man. All I can think about is just like, because you really, I mean, I'll say it again. This book has really put me in your place, mm-hmm. you know, during the reading of just rehearing it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just thinking about that. I'm like, my God, it's just, I mean, it's such a, you know, I don't even know. I'm not a very well-read person, Joe. Mm-hmm. Read a lot of books.
Yeah.
This one is great, and I have trouble finding words sometimes. So the only word that I can find is crazy. This experience is just crazy.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the experience that you went through is just, for lack of a better term, crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. I like to think it's a crazy book for. In more ways than one, but it's people have pointed out the humor in it. This is something that started to come out of it. And the other thing I like about it is how not unconscious unplanned the way it came out is. I simply tried to enter into the headspace that I was in, and you know I had journals, I had the medical record from all my time in the hospital,
yeah.
the daily psychiatric notes.
Which you do include some of that, some of these conversations that were actually written down and recorded.
Yeah, like that dialogue in that suicide scene comes from my later 1979 interview with Mike the security guard, where I went back with my tape recorder and said, what do you remember about that? And we put together the scene and the things like... he told me, you asked me, do you have a gun? You could shoot me. And I literally don't actually remember saying that to him.
Yeah.
But I remember the whole scene very, very clearly.
Yeah.
But he kind of had a better grasp on the actual dialogue of the things that I said to him. Not really that surprising that the not crazy guy would remember more of the specifics of what we talked about.
For sure, And so you said that, and you said this earlier, like once you did get better, you went back, fairly soon after you left.
Right.
And wanted to actually kind of record this experience.
Yeah.
Were you initially thinking that you would just make this into a book someday?
Well, I actually had in mind doing like a feature story for the Seattle Times magazine because I had written for the Times magazine a few summers before this experience. I knew some of the editors there and such, and I had written some longer pieces. So I had this idea that I can do this feature story on my own experience. But what I didn't really realize is that from a psychotherapeutic standpoint, I was seeking closure. You know, I had this role. I'm the reporter, and that allowed me to play this role of reporter and not really have to get into the deeper stuff that was consciously get into the deeper stuff that was happening. But what was happening was I was going back and checking in with Patricia, my favorite psychiatric nurse, and saying, hey, here I am. I'm not crazy anymore. Let's have an adult conversation. And the trauma expert I talked to in the...
Was it about proving it to some of these people?
I don't think it felt, it was particularly with her because we had a really positive relationship. It wasn't like, here I am to prove that I'm sane now.
Right.
It was kind of like, she was kind of a mother figure, like, hey mom, look, I'm doing good, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, you're proud of me. And she was very, very affirmative. And the trauma expert that I dialogue with in the last section of the book, these current day dialogues with other psychotherapeutic professionals. He talks about how the trauma experience, whether it's a veteran or a thing like this, or somebody who's a victim of abuse, you kind of block out that section of your life in a little compartment. And the healing process is to knit it back together into regular reality by telling your story. And so that's kind of what I was doing with Patricia in that later 1979 interview, and also with Dr. Early, who I continued to see.
Yeah,
he was definitely a bridge person, and I interviewed Mike, the security guard.
Yeah, yeah. Now, when did you start actually writing the book?
About 2007, 2008.
Oh, okay. So a while after the 1979.
Yeah,
obviously
30 years or something. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What did it feel like coming back into this?
You mean back into the story?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'd always thought it as a writer. I always thought of it as like this greatly procrastinated writing assignment, you know. So when I opened up the box and I flipped open the medical record, my hands were shaking, my heart was racing, and I recognized, oh, this is a response here. It's greater than I thought it would be. And I start reading the nurse's notes, these descriptions of my of me and my behavior and stuff. It was and the way they saw me, and it was just highly emotional, and that probably explains why what I thought would take me like a year to write took 7 years.
Years
to write. And by the way, shout out to my wife Nancy Guppy,
who's been on this show
before.
Yeah.
Her support and patience and criticism of a critical eye on the writing has been just invaluable.
Yeah. Now that's one thing I wanted to talk to you about too, is like, what was Nancy's thoughts? Because a lot of this book does have to do with dredging up old feelings of, of past love.
Yeah, well, yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah.
Like I would just imagine like even just talking about ex-girlfriends with my wife is a sore subject.
Yeah, yeah.
Like writing a whole book about.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I suppose it's because all the events took place, you know, 5 years before I met Nancy.
Sure.
But yeah, I think it's wonderful that she doesn't get bummed out about that or anything.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
In fact, one of the girlfriends that's mentioned in here, not the central love of my life person, but another one that's mentioned in here. She's we were in contact through Facebook, and she it was really cool because she's like talking about her memories of that time and like that, and so that was a really neat. But we've always been very friendly and friends. It was never like any breakup. It's weird at the breakup, but we kind of stayed friends and friendly the whole time.
That's good.
And so you know, Nancy's all aware of that. It's no problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
So getting it back into all this information, flipping through your journals, looking at some of the artwork that you made while you were there.
Yeah. The occupational therapy. Artwork.
I mean, you stated that you were hesitant to do this. Your hands were shaking. You were I don't know. There was some fear there of opening this back up, opening this old wound.
Yeah.
Was there any fear about reopening that crack in your psyche that this could come back?
Yeah.
Somehow?
No, I never had that sense that I could relapse back into psychosis or something. Although for the first 5 years, I guess they play it just like the medical professionals see it similar to like a cancer remission. You know, they say if you're 5 years clean, then you're in good shape. They told us the same thing about this mental illness thing, that if you were clean for 5 years. So for the first 5 years, I was pretty nervous about relapse and I was, in the 1980s alternative theater scene in Seattle, which was a pretty crazy place to be, pre grunge era and all that, but the kind of the dark humor that characterizes Seattle, both in comedy and in music and such, was really helpful for me to kind of be in that accepting world.
Yeah.
I think I wandered quite far off your question right there, but
This show is all about tangents.
Okay.
About tangents.
Tangent show.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So really opening this stuff back up, you basically took more of a journalistic approach to everything. Like, this is a story that I want to tell.
Well,
it's not something that you're afraid of telling.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it was journalistic. I was more motivated as a therapist to want to take a look at this case for like that. A psychoanalyst who I just met with said, "This is the best case study I've ever read. Most case studies are 20 pages or something. This is a full length memoir. So that I wanted to show people the experience. I wanted to advocate for the kind of treatment that I received, which that was helpful to me. The compassion, the listening, the being with human to human. You see, the most of the I met with five different psychiatrists, and only one of them, Dr. Leiter in the book, presented himself to me and met me on a human to human level as another human being. The mm-hmm. the other psychiatrists, probably more than even kind of weird psychiatric nurses that I sometimes encountered, were very robotic and distant. And as one of my colleagues said later in the dialogues, that was an ideal, which I think is still followed, of the physician not wanting to interfere with the microbe or the in the petri dish. You know, you don't want to interfere with the sample of madness that you have in the petri dish in front of you. Sort of a uber scientific point of view.
So they're more looking at it like a not. Like an experiment that they want to watch?
Well, yeah. Now their intention is, of course, not to be evil scientists or anything that. Their intention is to kind of diagnose and analyze from a scientific standpoint. They don't want to contaminate the operating room or something with their personality, you know, so they want to be very blank and this kind of thing. But in a human to human encounter, that just doesn't function. It doesn't function in a healing way. It makes the clinician appear to be bizarre.
Now
it's a fine line. It's like I say in the book that Patricia was like a traveler between worlds. She could hold herself in real reality, join me in my reality, and gently invite me over to the other side if I chose to come over there. And Dr. Leiter essentially did the same thing. But one of the philosophers that we studied in my program at Seattle University is named Emmanuel Levinas, and he talks about the face-to-face, the human encounter, the face-to-face. So right now, we're looking at we got eye contact right now.
Yeah.
And there's something sort of what he calls sort of infinitely wondrous about the human to human face to face. It can't be what he calls totalized. The infinity of the experience of the human encounter can't be totalized or encapsulated. And we could also say can't be thrown into a diagnostic category or treated through, quote, evidence-based, manual-driven therapies, points 1 through 10. And while some of those therapies...
That makes so much sense to me.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, just doing this show, I much rather have the person here in studio. We do, you know, phone conversations with some people sometimes.
Right, yeah.
But, therapy aside, talking to somebody about something that may be a serious subject, as in religion or psychotherapy. Mm. Like, I mean, you're not going to have a real conversation with somebody about that over the phone.
Yeah.
You know?
There's so many nonverbal cues we pick up. And one of the bummers about our current technological world, although there's a lot of really great things about it, is the loss of the face to face.
Yeah, for sure. So did your experience with the I keep on wanting to call her Nurse Ratched, but Dr. Patricia, was she a doctor?
She's definitely not Nurse Ratched. She's the opposite.
Right. She was the complete opposite.
She's the antimatter Nurse Ratched. Yeah.
But did she? Did her your experiences with her push you into pursuing a career in psychotherapy?
Not specifically in any way, because I had this 15-year career in the arts and television theater, writing for television.
You worked on Almost Live.
Worked on Almost Live. Yeah. Nancy and I went to Los Angeles for 4 years and worked on television shows down there.
Oh,
and,
cool.
And all that. So it wasn't until I felt like going into a change of career that I thought, oh yeah, I've been to, subsequently been to in therapy, and got into recovery as a matter of fact, for addiction issues. And so I thought, yeah, being a therapist, that's a cool thing. But I was also teaching writing, and I would work with, people would hire me to work one-on-one with their writing, and sometimes it was personal. And I started thinking, well, this is kind of like doing therapy, but I'm not trained. I don't have a license.
Right.
And,
right.
And so I decided to just kind of go mainstream and found this program in existential phenomenological psychotherapeutic psychology at...
sounds really complicated.
Yeah, it's actually simpler than it sounds, at Seattle University. And it just was a perfect match because they're very literary oriented. They're very philosophically oriented.
Sure.
And they're not running rats and through mazes in the basement, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And so that was a perfect match. So certainly in retrospect, I'm influenced by the way a nurse Patricia or a Dr. Leiter treated me, but it wasn't any kind of conscious thing at all when I decided to get into the field.
Yeah, yeah. Now once you started getting into it, you have said in the book and in here that some of the stuff that or the type of therapy that was practiced on you was the complete opposite of where you wanted to take your career, right?
Yeah, some of it was like that. Fortunately, there were enough sort of human to human people working there. That I was able to grab what the lifelines that I needed. I think this is really perfectly illustrated by this technique that they used then, and that you still see in with television psychotherapists do, and I don't know who uses it. It's called confrontative therapy, kind of in your face. Let me slap you around a little bit and wake you up, and you know, give you a reality check. And even that has some sort of place, but it can easily be very harsh. Well, anyway, they practiced that. It was the 1970s. It's like, let's get honest, put you on the hot seat, and that kind of stuff. It was practiced at the Seattle Mental Health Institute, which was right across the street from the halfway house. It's called Sound Mental Health today. The place is still there. But there were two group therapists there who both kind of practiced this, but they practiced it in completely opposite styles. One of them in the book used it in kind of a snarky, I got your number, sarcastic kind of way. And then, but the other one, he used it in the following way. At one point, I came there. I was really depressed, and I said the topic was feelings, you know. And I said in the group, I don't have any feelings. I feel dead inside.
I just read this part.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he looked at me eye to eye, face to face, with, and that's where he made the kind of the human connection. And then he says to me, with a bit of a smile on his face, supposing I told you that you are a spineless twerp, can you feel that? But it was said in this humorous way, and I did feel it though. Spineless twerp, you can't call me that, jerk, you know. And in that confrontative way, he awakened my feelings of anger. He also awakened my feelings of laughter because of the way he delivered it, and. You can imagine that being delivered in like a harsh way that would be like a put down, but which was the other guy.
Yeah.
But that was a real turning point, an amazing turning point in my.
So that worked.
It worked. It took me out of this idea I had in my depression that I'm dead. I'm numb. I no longer thought I was literally dead and in hell anymore.
Right,
I knew
right.
I was in reality. Reality being, I live in a halfway house. I'm on welfare. I don't know what my future could possibly be like. That was the depressing reality I was living in. But that idea, you have no feelings, it's like, boom, I have feelings. I can feel the sting of your kind of joking but effective comment.
Right, right.
And the other thing he said to me was, you can't move on from where you are unless you accept where you are. Those are words to live by at any time of life.
Sure. Sure. That's amazing, man.
Yeah.
Well, it's an amazing book. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. And this is by far the most, research I've ever done before an interview.
Oh. All right.
I read the whole book. I haven't read the whole book. That's a flat out lie. Cause I've got about 20 pages left, but I plan on finishing it. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, thank you very much.
It's a very real experience and one that I can't totally relate to, but there are parts in there that really, hit it home for me.
Well, good. I think a lot, lots of people have similar experiences or they've had slightly similar experiences, or they fear this experience.
Sure,
so,
sure.
So I hope yeah. people relate to it and get a lot out of it.
Yeah. And you said you were just talking with another psychotherapist that wanted to use it as kind of a teaching tool.
Yeah, I've already been to some classrooms at Seattle University yeah. with the material.
That's amazing.
Yeah, this person is with the I'm going to get the name wrong. Psychoanalytic Institute. So she's trains psychoanalysts who are
wow.
coming into the field.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's got to. I mean, that's got to feel pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, terrific. And yeah. she was drawing this sort of deeper questions out of it. So I just love that. So she's going to send me some of her comments and thoughts from a psychoanalytic perspective, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that.
That's wonderful, Joe. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming and chatting with
you're,
me.
You're welcome.
I've thoroughly enjoyed this.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. So where can we find the book?
Well, locally it's available at Elliott Bay Books. Queen Anne Book Company has it. I know Finney Ridge Books. And then, of course, it's Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, available through iBooks, Kindle Store, blah,
wonderful.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So everywhere.
Everywhere.
Is there a yeah. website or anything like that that you want to push people towards? Or
JoeGuppyWriter.com
okay.
is there. Yeah.
Yeah.
JoeGuppyWriter.com is a Facebook page called My Fluorescent God, a memoir.
Yeah. So yeah. going like that, because that actually does feel good.
Yeah,
I don't know if it transfers into like you know listeners or readers, but you know, it feels good getting likes on Facebook. Right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
yeah,
yeah. yeah. So it's good for our egos. Well, yeah. Joe, thank you so much once again.
Yeah,
it's been an absolute pleasure, and you can find
you,
out.
You're
welcome.
Yeah,
you're
thank
welcome.
You for having me on. It's a great, very good conversation.
Good. I hope it's been one of your best because you have been all over the place lately.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay, and you can find out more about us at www.air-raid.net and on iTunes and everywhere where podcasts are available. And remember, we want you guys to take the pledge and pledge to share this show with a friend or a sister or a brother or a mother or a father. Even a cousin will take cousins as well. All right, thank you guys for listening. Have a great week.